Well, we're starting a new series this evening, and over the next 5 weeks or so, I think we're going to be looking at the book of Esther, which is probably not a book that you look at very often. I have to say, I can't remember a sermon series on Esther before. I expect there has been, but I don't remember it. So I thought it'd be good to actually start by giving a bit of an introduction to the book of Esther. So it's a book of the Old Testament. It's the last of the sort of historical books. Its author, unknown. We don't actually know who wrote the book of Esther. All we know really is, and that this is a bit of detective work, is that it was probably written by a Jew, because the theme is part of the history of the Jewish nation. When was it written? Well, we don't actually know when it was written. But the action takes place during the reign of King Xerxes, who reigned from about 486 to 465 BC. So it obviously wasn't written before 460 BC. So that's narrowed it down a little bit. Where does it take place? Well, it takes place in Persia, modern-day Iran, mainly set in the city of Susa. That's one of the sort of main capital cities in Persia at that time. And what was its purpose? Well, two things really. One of it was to remind the Jews why a particular festival had been set up, the festival of Purim, which apparently, although I'm not very good with my Jewish calendar, apparently it is still celebrated today in certainly some of the Jewish tradition. And also, it's a reminder of the great deliverance of the Jewish people from the threat of destruction at the hands of Xerxes and the Persian Empire. It was another time when the Jewish people were threatened with destruction. So, it's an important historical book describing a key event in the life of the Jewish nation, but it's slightly odd. Because actually there's no explicit reference to God in the whole of the book. Or to worship, or to prayer, or to sacrifice. So you might ask the question, well, why is the book being included in the canon of the Bible then? It doesn't even mention God. Well, hopefully we'll see as we go through the book over these next few weeks that although there isn't any specific mention of God, he's actually there, he's working in the background. He's using events and he's working in the lives of his people. So we've got quite a lot of ground to cover this evening, most of the first two chapters of the book of Esther. So I thought it'd be best to actually split it into two. So we'll have the first chapter and then I'll speak a little bit about that. And then we'll have a song in between to wake you all up again. And then we'll go on to the second section. Chris has drawn the short straw of reading. When I asked him this morning, he volunteered quite happily. But when I saw him a little bit early, he said, it's a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. There's some really good words, some real nice names in here. So, if you'd like to follow along, we're reading Esther chapter 1, which is on page 501.
Well, I wasn't going to say it was difficult, because Sue reminded me that if you say words confidently enough, then you'll believe that that's how you meant to say them. So we're reading from Esther, chapter 1, reading the whole chapter. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces, were present. For the full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet, lasting 7 days. In the enclosed garden of the king's palace, for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abitha, Zetha, and Carsus, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Kishina, Shetha, Admartha, Tarshish, Mears, Messina, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media, who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Mehunan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded the Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all the vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Mehukin proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household.
Brilliant. Thanks, Chris. Well done. So, putting it into a bit of historical context again then, you remember that the kingdom of, well, the Israelites had been split into two kingdoms, a north kingdom, which was Israel, and that had been conquered and carried off by the Assyrians. And then there was the southern kingdom of Judah. And they'd had a mixture of good and bad kings, and they'd managed to last for about 400 years. But in 600 BC, they too were conquered, and they were carried off into exile in Babylon. Well, eventually the Babylonian Empire was defeated by Persia, who then became the sort of the greatest power. And Xerxes, their king, was ruling over a kingdom of 127 provinces, stretching from India in the east to North Africa in the west. That's a huge area, isn't it? Massive area. So he was a really powerful king. And just before his time, King Cyrus of Persia had allowed some of the Jews to start returning from their exile into Jerusalem so that they could rebuild the temple. So something like 50 to 60,000 of the Jews had actually made their way back to Jerusalem, and they were beginning to rebuild the temple, which took something like 60 years. And we can then read about that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. So it was during this sort of 60-year period that the events in Esther take place. So many of the Jews were still living in exile in Persia. They hadn't all gone back to Israel. And the scene of this first chapter anyway is mainly in the royal palace, in the citadel, in that city of Susa. It's a large city, around about 200 miles east of Babylon. It's a city that actually archaeologists have excavated, and they've found quite a number of the locations that you'll hear about in the book. So it's from here that Xerxes ruled his huge kingdom. In some translations, you might hear the word Ahasuerus, something like that, Ahasuerus, that's it, Ahasuerus, instead of Xerxes. That's just an alternative name, but it's a more of a sort of generic name. It's more like a name, king or pharaoh. So we'll use Xerxes, and he ruled for 21 years. So when we meet him at the beginning of the story, he's putting on quite a show. So a little bit, I was trying to think of an example of something similar, and the only thing I could come up with was a sort of great exhibition of its time. 180 days of banqueting and displays of wealth and power, and it was really designed to wow the other kings and the nobles, because Xerxes wanted to put together a large army to take on the Greeks. And so he was encouraging them to provide their men and their sort of war material for that war against the Greeks. And as a bit of an aside, he actually was successful in building up an army thought to be somewhere between 1 and 2 million people. So it was, you know, quite an undertaking. It turned out to be a disastrous campaign, but we're not too worried about that. Then at the end of that 180 days of partying, he holds a special 7-day banquet for all the people in the citadel. And I don't know if you noticed as we were going through the detail about that banquet. It was in the enclosed garden of the royal palace. There were hangings of white and blue linen. There were couches of gold and silver. There was a mosaic pavement made out of precious stones. There were goblets of gold, each one individually made and marked. So they obviously hadn't gone to the Susa version of IKEA at the time. What a display of power and money and opulence. And wine was abundant. I'm sure it was good quality stuff. And what was unusual was that the guests were allowed to actually drink as they saw fit. That's actually quite unusual, because normally at that sort of a do, you follow the king's example. If the king's drinking and getting drunk, then it's all right for you to do the same. If the king's laying off the wine, then you lay off the wine as well. But not here. No, no, all the guests were allowed to drink as they saw fit. Needless to say, after 7 days of this, the boys were wasted. And while all this was going on, of course, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women. That's it. No description about what happened there. That's it. She also gave a banquet for the women. But that, well, that wasn't really important, was it, for the women? The women who were actually the members of the king's harem. So in the, apparently in the culture of the time, many of the big decisions were actually made by the rulers when they were drunk. When they sobered up the next day, this decision would then be ratified or rejected. Makes you wonder, doesn't it, about today's leaders and politicians. Would their decisions be any better if they were taken whilst drunk? Well, yeah, sometimes wonder, don't we? So the picture really is of a king. He's a king with immense power and wealth. But as we'll see, he's lacking in wisdom. Wealth and power and wisdom don't always sit together, as we can probably see in the world around us today. So on the seventh day, when the king was in high spirits from wine, he was in his cups, as we say sometimes nowadays. He was drunk. He commanded the eunuchs who were in charge of the harem to bring his queen before him, Queen Vashti. She was his prized possession, really. She was clearly a beauty. The Bible says that she was lovely to look at. Now, bringing her before all these rulers and so on wasn't, there's no hint of impropriety here. He wanted to show her off because of her beauty. But the queen refused. She was actually in quite a difficult position, because it was shameful, really, for somebody in her position to actually show her face in public. It's actually a bit like the Muslim tradition nowadays, isn't it? Women are not normally showing their faces in public. So it would have been below her station, really, to have done that. So she's got a difficult decision to make. Either she's going to obey the command of the king and go before him and display her beauty with her face uncovered, or disobey the command of the king and hope that the king would be sympathetic to her plight. He wasn't. Verse 12, he said it was furious and burning with anger. And he was humiliated, really, wasn't he, if you think about it, because despite all this wealth and all this power that he could show, he couldn't even command his own household. His own wife was disobedient. It's not always easy for us to take the moral high ground, is it, when we have difficult decisions? Just think about the sort of thing that might happen. Perhaps you're asked by an employer to do something that's not quite right or illegal. Do you go along with it? Or maybe you see some wrongdoing in somebody else. Somebody else is doing something that is not right. Or maybe you're asked to turn a blind eye to a situation. Sometimes making that right moral choice is difficult for us, isn't it? It can leave us isolated, or it can leave us facing negative consequences. Sometimes we need to stand up and be counted, rather than just going along with what our society seems to be or deems to be acceptable. And there's echoes here of this morning's sermon, isn't there, from Revelation, the letter sent to the church in Pergamum, whose problem was that they were going along with society. They were being too tolerant. They weren't standing up against things that were wrong. And as we know that as Christians, we have that special responsibility to stand up, because the Holy Spirit heightens our conscience, doesn't it? We do know right from wrong. So for Queen Vashti, the result of her defiance was a loss of her position, and she was, in effect, returned to the harem. But actually, if you look at the manner of that change, it's actually a little bit comical almost, isn't it? And I think the writer was close to actually poking a little bit of fun at Xerxes. Because the first thing that the king does, this all-powerful God, what does he do? Well, he summons his trusted advisors, who turn out to be the court astrologers. Wise men who understood the time. But they turn out to be a bit foolish, really, don't they? Their advice is not brilliant. Their first bit of advice really, actually, starts by making a mountain out of a molehill. Because instead of a threat to the king's authority, they argue that her behaviour will be it will escalate into a whole national crisis, nationwide. All people, all women will follow her example, and there will be universal breakdown in respect, there will be contempt, and the position of men would be jeopardised. It's Women's Lib and the Me Too thing rolled into one, isn't it? It's the Persian equivalent, actually, at the time. You think of Facebook and Instagram in Persia at the time, they'd be full of negative comments, wouldn't they? So how do you stop that disaster from happening? Well, you issue a royal decree, an edict. And the first part of that is for Queen Vashti, who's refused to come into the king's presence. So what does the edict say? Well, Queen Vashti will be prevented from coming into the king's presence. Sounds a bit daft, actually, doesn't it? And in case some people haven't heard of the king's shame, let's send an edict to everyone across the kingdom so that they know, and command every woman to respect their husbands and masters. That should sort it out. Brilliant. You can imagine the thinking, can't you? We can't have this. If Queen Vashti can get away with that sort of behaviour, that sort of disobedience, then all women will treat their husbands that way. And so the edict was sent. It went across the kingdom. It says it went in all languages. Well, that certainly does make a mountain out of a molehill, doesn't it? So that's really set us up for the rest of the story. We've got a proud, a rich, but perhaps a bit of a foolish king. We've got a queen who's been deposed and returned to the ranks, leaving a vacancy. We've got a national law against that almost guaranteed to lead to contempt rather than respect. Just imagine a law being passed like that today. Respect has to be earned, doesn't it? It's not just commanded. Although the rich and the powerful, the leaders were also petty and foolish. One of the commentators I read said that, of course, this is one of the worst combinations. Power in the hands of a fool. In such cases, a nation is in real danger. It's ruled by the pride and arrogance of buffoons whose egos command the nation's laws and powers for their own selfish and childish causes. Well, thank God that's not relevant today. Notice, though, that we have so far had no mention of God in the book, have we? And perhaps surprisingly, we actually haven't had any mention of Esther either yet. Fear not, our heroine does appear in the next chapter, which we'll be looking at shortly, when the king holds a Miss Persia pageant.
So we're now moving on to chapter 2. Not quite the whole chapter this time, just the first 18 verses. So starting at verse 1. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem of the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features. And Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatment and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there and in the morning return to another part of the harem for the care of Sashka, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the term came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the tenth month, the month of Tebah, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality.
Great, thanks very much, Chris. So returning to the story then, King Xerxes. He's actually been off to war. It didn't actually say it specifically, but in the interim, he's been off to war against Greece, and he's returned, and he's remembered his banishment of Vashti, and he was probably looking for a bit of solace as well, because his war hadn't gone well at all. So the time had come for him to look for a replacement. And this time the king's personal attendants had provided the advice. They said, let's gather together all the most beautiful virgins in the kingdom, and you can choose the most beautiful as your queen. Again, perhaps not the greatest advice, but advice that appeals, because it's based on only one criterion, really, isn't it? Beauty. What about all the other qualities that are important in building a healthy relationship? Imagine nowadays choosing a wife on looks alone. That would be a recipe for disaster, I suspect, wouldn't it? And you would have thought so in this story of the king too. But remember that God is at work. And so the woman he has in mind isn't just a pretty face. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. So there's much detail given in the process of selection. The beautiful virgins are rounded up from right the way across the kingdom, and they were added to the harem, and they were given 12 months of beauty treatment. So they were beautiful in the first place, but they still needed 6 months of oil of myrrh and 6 months of perfumes and cosmetics. Wow. Then they were selected to spend one night with the king. And if they were rejected, then they were sent to a separate part of the palace for the concubines. And finally, we get to meet the star of the show. Because there's a Jew called Mordecai living in Susa, and within his care is a younger cousin who's been orphaned. The girl's name is Hadassah. That's a Jewish name. But she's also known as Esther, which is a Persian name, which means myrtle. So Esther is beautiful, and really she's got no choice but to submit herself to this beauty pageant, if you like. She's taken to the harem, and she immediately finds favour with the eunuch who's in charge. She's given maids and special place in the harem, and she begins her beauty treatment. And she's given special food. And as we were looking at this, there's parallels here between this story and what we were thinking about the story. Remember the story of Joseph this morning, when he was taken into prison, and he immediately found favour with the person in charge of the prison and was put in charge. He was then taken into Potiphar's home. He immediately found accepted there, and he found favour, and he was put in charge of Potiphar's home. Again, Esther in this story, taken into the harem, and immediately finds favour with the people in charge. Now, as we were saying, God is at work in this. She was chosen apparently only because of her beauty, but that really wasn't the reason she was chosen. God was at work in this choice. Esther had been chosen by God to play a pivotal role in the future of the Jewish nation, as we'll see as we look in future weeks. Sorry, I got a bit lost there. So before we leave the story, let's look at what else Esther showed beyond her obvious beauty. Because we all know beauty can be a fragile thing, can't it? An accident or an illness can destroy a pretty face. Wrinkles and aging can't always be avoided. And the years can take their toll, can't they? So physical beauty is a gift from God, but perhaps it's not as important as beauty within. And this is what Esther showed, as well as her natural beauty. She showed a certain modesty, didn't she? Her beauty was natural, but she didn't sort of seek to enhance it. When she was given the opportunity to take anything with her in to see the king, she didn't take anything at all. She didn't need to. She didn't feel she needed to enhance what she had. She was modest about it. She was loyal. She was loyal to her cousin, Mordecai. I think I missed out a little bit on the previous page where Mordecai was really concerned about what was happening to Esther. And he was pacing up and down in the courtyard right through that period, trying to find out what was happening to her. But Esther stayed loyal to Mordecai. She followed his instructions before and after she became queen. She respected him as her guardian, the one who'd brought her up. She obeyed what she'd been told by Mordecai to keep her nationality, the fact that she was Jewish, to keep that a secret. So she was modest, she was loyal, she showed integrity. She didn't allow her newfound status to affect her relationship with Mordecai particularly. And as the story progresses, we'll see that having Esther installed as queen would be vital to the future of the Jewish nation, God's chosen people. And remember, see how God had been at work in the circumstances leading up to Esther's new position. The things that seemed to be a bit coincidental, the downfall of Queen Vashti and the fact that there was a vacancy there. The selection process of that new queen, which meant that Esther was called up along with many of the other beautiful girls from across the kingdom. But Esther won that competition. She won the contest. Xerxes wasn't aware of Esther's heritage. So make no mistake, God was at work in that story, and God is still at work in this world. He hasn't lost control. Although sometimes we can't see why things happen, can we? But God looks on the inside as I was saying when we were praying, he knows us through and through. He knows our inner being. He knows the people we are. And he uses us in ways that maybe we're totally unaware of. Esther trusted God, even though she was taking her life in her hands, literally sleeping with the enemy. Do we trust God to bring us through difficult times and situations? A couple of words from hymns. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. God is working his purpose out as year succeeds to year.